Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Manchester City won their game in hand last night, sort of simplifies things a little bit at the top of the Premier League. Although, frankly, I think myself and everyone else had already given the likes of Manchester City 3 points against Cardiff. But let's be honest, I don't think they were really very interested in the game. And frankly, I don't think many of the Man City fans were either. It was painfully obvious on TV quite how many of them had either chosen to watch the game at home or in the pub, or frankly do something more interesting like starting their tax return. It wasn't an interesting game. There were moments, tax returns by the way. My boss Steve says he's already finished his tax return for the tax year that ends this week, which I think is a pretty sad indictment of how little he's got going on in his own life. But that's just my opinion. And I think he's an excellent boss and he signs my paychecks, crucially. But no one turned up at City last night. There were so many empty blue seats. And if you were dressed as an empty seat last night, you got a great view of, Neil Etheridge's goalkeeping display. Yeah, he made lots of saves. That was sort of vaguely interesting. By the way, only Lucas Fabianski has made more saves in the Premier League than he has. And Cardiff were, frankly, nowhere. There was no pressure on the ball. The fact that City only won 2-0, pretty remarkable to me. And I wasn't the only one slightly staggered. Here's Pep Guardiola.
We started really good. It's not easy to attack, defend man-to-man. And but we created incredible chances, especially second half. Unfortunately, we could not score more goals, but a good result. With this amount of games, always is important, you know, to do what they have done and the results we achieved.
Yeah, it is important to win, and City's goal difference is still 9 better than Liverpool. So if it does come down to goal difference, I don't think they'll be too worried. They've scored 83 times in the Premier League this year, which is pretty remarkable. By the way, their goal difference is 62, plus 62, compared to third place Tottenham, who are plus 26. That was a remarkable deficit. But yeah, they didn't score many. And credit to Etheridge, he did very well. It was quite funny afterwards. Neil Warnock said, yeah, serious shame about the first goal. Kevin De Bruyne firing it in at the near post. And Etheridge probably thinking he might have got a hand on it. He said De Bruyne got lucky. Warnock disagreed and then grabbed De Bruyne as he walked past in the tunnel and said, Kevin, you mean that? And he basically said, no, I got lucky. So some respite for Neil Etheridge there. Cardiff didn't offer much, though. Neil Warnock said beforehand, I don't think anyone in the bottom half of the table has much chance coming to the Etihad. Very defeatist. And no one seems to, frankly, want to come and watch Man City on a Wednesday night either. Or go and watch Man City in the FA Cup semi-final. As it stands, City will not sell out their allocation for Saturday's FA Cup semi against Brighton. That, to me, is staggering. I know City have been to a lot of cup finals, and I know it's a long way to come. But surely you want to come and see your team play in a cup semi-final in what could be a historic season. They could be the first team ever to win the quadruple. Maybe the first team and the last team. Who knows how long the League Cup's going to last. When that tournament goes, City might be consigned to history as the only English team to win all 4 major trophies. It could happen. And what, you're going to say, oh, I could have gone to the semi-final, but... Well, it's not all their fault. They were given 30,000 tickets originally, and then the FA gave them an extra 2,000, which City promptly went, nah, you're all right, and sent them back. They've only sold 25,000, so there's still 5,000 available. You can get them for about £30 at the moment, which for an FA Cup semi... I mean, I might go. I'm not a City fan, I'm not a Brighton fan, but I might just go. Chance to go to an FA Cup semi-final for half the price of the Champions League quarter-final at the new Tottenham Stadium. I don't see why you wouldn't. Well, the reason is, it's a 5:30 kickoff. Now, if you're travelling from Manchester, the difficulty is not getting down in time, it's getting back. Because it's a 5:30 kickoff, there are only 3 trains available for you to get back to Manchester that night, unless you want to pay for a hotel in London, which is obviously exorbitantly expensive. So it's not great planning on behalf of the FA. And it'll look bad. It looks bad last night when Man City have empty seats to the Etihad, and it'll look bad at Wembley on Saturday when there are bright red empty seats, which will be very obvious as every single fan will be wearing blue, and there'll be bright red empty seats looking down on FA Cup semi-final, a game which is supposed to be one of the pinnacles of the sporting calendar, certainly of the football calendar. it's pretty disappointing. And I think you'll find the FA come under a lot of pressure, as City will as well, by the way. They've got a little bit of a problem. Alexander Zinchenko went off last night with a hamstring problem. It leaves City short at left-back with Delph already injured. They might have to recall Benjamin Mendy, who, if you remember, recently got back at 3:30 from a night out, in the morning, that is, and was chastised for doing so by Guardiola. So, not all is well on the good ship Pep, just as not all is well on the good ship Seb. Sebastian Vettel, of course. He has been, frankly, outdriven by his brand new teammate, 21-year-old Charles Leclerc. Now, pressure's not new for someone like Sebastian Vettel. He's an F1 driver, he's a four-time world champion, and he drives for Ferrari. It's always pressurised in those sorts of situations. But he's not least under pressure by the Italian press. With Ferrari, they're the kind of people who are always going to be under scrutiny. With any luck, and I know Vettel's been learning Italian, but with any luck, it's not stretched too far because the papers have well and truly gone for him this week. La Gazzetta dello Sport. La Gazzetta dello Sport, one of Italy's sports newspapers, says Ferrari have one certainty and two problems. The certainty is Charles Leclerc, and the problems are reliability and Sebastian Vettel. That's pretty harsh for a four-time world champion. Corriere della Sera says Vettel has been humiliated. Ferrari are looking to the future, in which there is no room for Vettel. Mick Schumacher could be soon at the side of the talented Charles Leclerc. This is an added problem for Vettel that on Tuesday, a Schumacher drove a Ferrari around an F1 track in an F1 car. Mick Schumacher, son of the famous Michael Schumacher, seven-time world champion, he was out in the SF90 testing in Bahrain. He is driving in F2 this year, the second tier of Formula 1, for Prema, who are Ferrari's sister team, and he's in the Ferrari Racing Academy. So they clearly think he's got something and that he's worth giving time. I'm not saying Ferrari are going to boot Vettel out early. He's got one more year after this one on his current contract. But there is talk that he might end up moving. Now, where would he go? Well, I'll tell you what, Lewis Hamilton's not going to be at Mercedes forever. He is very ready to up sticks and move. He's always talked about wanting to go to Ferrari. Sebastian Vettel is best mates with Mercedes boss Toto Wolff. Even invited him to his 30th birthday party. Are we going to see the most audacious swap deal in history, where Sebastian Vettel and Lewis Hamilton swap teams? I mean, that would be, it would be like Manchester United and Manchester City swapping Sergio Aguero and Marcus Rashford. It really would be. Like, it would be the most unbelievable thing, but it genuinely could happen. And if you've got a bit bored with F1, because I know this happens, some people say, oh, I used to watch loads of F1, I used to love it, but it's dull now. If you're a bit bored of F1, I recommend you get back involved this year, because it's an exciting field this year. There's a couple of very talented drivers, and there is an added storyline. Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian Vettel are both looking for somewhere else to be in 2021. That might be NASCAR. It might be rally driving. It might be anything. It might not be F1, but it might also be a different F1 team. With Charles Leclerc adding some extra talent into the field, the 21-year-old in a Ferrari, with Valtteri Bottas looking like a new driver next to Lewis Hamilton at Mercedes, and with both top teams challenging each other both for pace and handling, I think we might have quite the title battle on our hands.
Love Sport.
Just been handed a very useful sheet of paper with some nice bits of information on it. Always good of my producer, Ben, to make me look clever. He says, oh, by the way, it's double-sided. Well, he's not wrong, because all pieces of paper are intrinsically double-sided. There's just nothing on the back, so no? Right, okay, I've just been stitched up there. We are, of course, talking horse racing next, because Aintree starts today. The one we're all talking about is, of course, the Grand National on Saturday at 5:15. Office sweepstakes are starting. Have you pulled an absolute stinker? I suspect you have. I can already smell in the office the scent of rigging a sweepstake draw. I can see breakfast producer Jamie planning exactly how he's going to make sure that he mugs us all off with some underhand tactics. So I will be keeping a very beady eye on the sweepstake. And a man who will be keeping a very beady eye on everything at Aintree this week is Neil Watson, horse racing journalist. He's on the line now. Neil, where does Aintree for you rank in terms of the festivals over the year?
Oh, well, I'm from the Northwest, so for me, this is my premier race meeting of the whole lot. You know, I like the Derby, I like the Cheltenham Gold Cup and the Cheltenham Festival. I love all the classics, but as a local lad, I live 60 miles away. This, for me, is the best that it can get.
And of course, we have to talk about the National because we've now got the 40-strong field. Of course, it's headed by Tiger Roll, looking to do something that hasn't been done in many decades. Do you see any reason that he wouldn't? He's very short at 7-2.
Well, the only thing what does put me off is the price for a 40 in a field.
Mm.
But he's a fantastic little horse. People love him. He's a sort of a horse which jumpy fans just love. It's very rare. It used to be very rare that Grand National winners would win again. You'd always get lumped with top weights. But you look over the years, Pino Duray has won again, so too many clouds and no Tiger Roll. I think there's plenty of each way value in the contest. Joe Farrell, who just sneaked in, has been supported during the week. Vintage Clouds and Lakeview Lad in the colours of Trevor Headings. People would love to see that, see him win. One for our third previous winner for Scotland. Key for two, Lizzie Kelly. Can she be the first woman to ride a Grand National winner? It's plausible for me. And course specialists as well, such as Ultra Gold, Burley on Reed. It just makes for an intriguing and puzzling kind of contest.
Well, it sounds like there's no shortage of contenders anyway. A very short price for the favourite, but I suspect that it really could come from anywhere. What are the conditions like at Aintree likely to be this week?
Well, at the moment, I'm looking outside from the press room and it's chipping down with rain.
Okay.
So I'm glad I'm in the dry. But the good thing it will do, it'll take the sting out of the ground.
Yeah.
So for any jockeys who fall, it'll be a lot better than falling on soft ground than falling on hard ground.
Mm. And presumably, a softer ground, you tend to see fewer tired horses and fewer big falls, which is, of course, what we all want to avoid at the Grand National.
Oh, look, everybody knew. The one thing, any punter who follows this sport like a true fan, all they want is for all 40 horses to go out on Saturday and come back home in one piece.
Mm, exactly. Agreed. Neil, thank you very much for your expert insight. Always a pleasure to have someone who knows what they're talking about.
This is Love Sport.
Guy Watts, posh sports reporter, has strolled into the studio because there are cricket stories galore today involving some of the greats of the county game. Let's face it, Alastair Cook and Marcus Trescothick both in the headlines for sort of similar but also different reasons today, Guy.
Yeah, I'd be almost certain in saying they never opened together for England, but what a pair they would have been.
Mm.
You know, of course, essentially, Trescothick's retirement from international cricket really opening the door to Alastair Cook to begin that extremely long and continuous career that only came to an end at the end of last summer. Yeah, so there's a piece today by Mike Atten in the Times. As always, it's thought-provoking, and it's all about how we might have gone about kind of handling Alastair Cook a little bit differently from an England perspective. So he recalls the winter of 2016, where we were, of course, thrashed by India. I think we lost the series 4-0. We also only managed to draw in Bangladesh. And it was after that series that he finally resigned the captaincy. He'd been captain, of course, since Andrew Strauss had resigned 4 and a bit years before. And he really was a man who had looked like the toll, you know, had been mounting on him for quite a while. Our results hadn't been great. His batting for a long time in that captaincy period hadn't been great either. And although he managed a couple more fantastic knocks, a couple of double hundreds, of course, in his career as a sort of specialist batsman, after the captaincy, he never really regained the form that he showed, especially early on in the early days of his captaincy and before he became captain. And Mike Atten suggests that maybe around the time of winter 2016, he was just 31, birthday on Christmas Day, of course, a bit like Marcus Trescothick. And maybe we might have sort of taken him aside and said, Alistair, we want you still to be playing for England in 5 years, maybe even longer than that, recalling that Graham Gooch's mentor played and had the most productive years of his career in his late 30s. And we might have said to him, Alistair, how about you take a few months off, 6 months off maybe, even a whole summer, and return maybe for the next winter campaign. You come back recharged, refreshed, with a little bit of a new perspective. Joe Root, the next captain, has had a chance to kind of stamp his authority on the team. And hopefully we get something close to a fully fit and firing Alastair Cook again. A sabbatical, if you will. And he suggests that it might have had the same effect that it had on a few of New Zealand rugby's biggest stars. Richie McCaw and Dan Carter both did the same before the 2015 World Cup. What happened? They came back, they starred, and they won the World Cup.
Well, because people forget, I think, especially with cricket and especially with captaining a side, it is an immersive, exhaustive experience, because not only have you got all the duties that you have, you've got to play all the games, and that's a certain number of days, you've got to be at all the training sessions, a certain number of days, you've also got additional stuff. You've got to go in on other people's days off and do bits of media, or you've got to go to committee meetings or attend certain media commitments, and all of that mounts up, especially when, you know, like Alice Cook, for example, he's got a young family, he's a bit of a homeboy, isn't he? He lives out on his farm. He likes to be in his own environment. And yeah, I actually don't think Alastair Cook's international career is over.
Do you not?
Well, I just see it. I just see there's almost an inevitability
he
about it.
He said he's played his last game for England, James. I think I think he probably has. You know, I really think he has. We've got to be moving on, because I really don't think, even if he scores buckets of runs in the county game, at international level, I think his race is run. You know, it was quite clearly run for a good year before he announced he was retiring. I know he produced that magic at the Oval. I was there to see it. It was incredible. But I think we knew that he was only able to do it because he knew it was the last time he was ever going to have to do it.
You mentioned another man with great longevity, Marcus Trescothick, and you mentioned that you don't think they'd ever open the batting for England before. So their test careers perfectly dovetailed. They did not overlap in test matches. But Alistair Cook made his ODI debut back in 2006. I don't know if you remember Sri Lanka visiting in 2006 when they absolutely murdered us.
Like, did Dilshan just score millions of runs?
It was Sanath Jayasuriya, Taranga and Jayawardena doing the damage, with Kumar Sangakkara chipping in. And in the fourth ODI, we threw Alistair Cook into the mix. He opened with Trescothick.
They put
on 77. And in the fifth, we lost, obviously, chasing more than 300 and failing to do so. And in the fifth ODI, they opened together again. They put on 82. So they have an average of 80 opening together. Trescothick got 100. We made 321.
Wow.
And Sri Lanka knocked them off in 37 overs.
What?
Sanath Jayasuriya got 152 off 99 balls. Yes, I don't know if you remember this, but the England bowling attack consisted of Kabir Ali, a young Liam Plunkett, and Steve Harmison. In that game, by the way, Steve Harmison bowled 10 overs for 97 runs.
Oh, my God. They are the most expensive ever figures by an England bowler.
Yeah, certainly 10 overs. I mean, Kabir Ali opened the bowling and went for 72 off his 6 overs.
Oh, my God.
Tim Bresnan only bowled 2 overs because they went for 29. Honestly, I remember that series very well because it was just after, you know, the 05 Ashes series, and Sri Lanka came to England. And the test series, I think we may have drawn with them. In a quite exciting test series, and we went into one day cricket and it was absolutely
horrendous. Things have changed. Although, interestingly, one player who I do think could actually still be playing, not maybe necessarily in his current guise, but if you took a Marcus Trescothick in his pomp, he's probably the one player from that era. If you include Kevin Peterson in that bracket, then he, of course, I think wouldn't look out of place in the current one day team. But Marcus Trescothick, in my opinion, would be probably the first name on a team sheet of an England all-time ODI 11. And remarkably, 12 and a bit years after he last played any international cricket, he is still going for Somerset. He may wear glasses now, he may be a little thicker around the waist, but at 43 years, 3 months and 10 days, tomorrow he will begin a remarkable 27th season, all of course for one county, Somerset, one of three remaining first-class counties to have never won the county championship. They came oh so close 3 years ago, and he still is chasing that dream of being part of the first ever Somerset team to win the county championship. It could happen, but either way, it's a remarkable testament to a fantastic player, a guy who has so many obvious flaws in his technique but has made it kind of made him a stronger player for it, who played a lot at international level but not as much as he might have. And he's still, you know, if you're able to go to Taunton, going to be giving you the gift of runs, I imagine.
In some ways, he was a very modern cricketer, because even right from the start, he didn't really move his feet. He pretty much just stood there and whacked it. And that is quite a modern way of approaching batting, where actually the most important thing is having a still head, a solid base, and putting your weight through the ball. That is kind of how modern batting is done, as opposed to the sort of uber-technical footwork of the early 2000s, perhaps. So maybe he was miles ahead of his time.
He was a little bit, I think, and he wouldn't have obviously still been playing for England now, but the point is that he would have had an England career, especially in limited overs formats. 2020, I should think he would have still been a contender to play in the England team for a few years after he stopped playing international cricket. But because he was exactly that, you know, he was a fantastic white ball player, not to mention a pretty good test opener as well. And it was a real shame we lost him when we did. But I think, tellingly with Trescothick, he's someone who, while he's still playing, is already kind of getting involved in a way in the game that it normally takes you being retired to do. So he helps out Ed Smith and James Taylor, the England selectors. He's one of their scouts, one of their sort of extra pairs of eyes around the game that they consult when it comes to selection. And I suspect that in his official retirement, which you imagine will come at some point, although maybe not, in his official retirement...
Are you suggesting that Marcus Trescothick is going to play until he dies?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible.
The year is 2055 and Marcus Trescothick, at the age of 79, is still opening the batting for Somerset and probably still scoring runs.
Probably would be. You know, he doesn't actually wear glasses at any time other than when he's playing cricket.
Really?
So his eyes must still be pretty good by most 43-year-old
Because that's
standards.
What they say is the thing that gets you to retire, isn't it? When the eyes go, you just go, yeah, no, I can't do this
And obviously
anymore.
that's luck as much then. You can't really you know, no practice and amount of practice or skill can affect how your eyesight develops or fails to. So yeah, we'll well, if you pardon the pun, be watching him keenly this summer to see if he can repeat some of the feats of his glorious past.
I suspect one thing he won't be doing this summer, given his commitment to Somerset and, well, you know, his want to take some time off his playing in the 100. Now,
no one will this summer, James. Doesn't start till next year.
No, exactly. But the key point here is that he will not have to pay back 12.5% of his salary to his county. Is that right?
Well, that's the point of dispute, really, among the PCA, the Professional Cricketers Association. They were supposed to have signed an agreement covering kind of future contracts and payment arrangements by the end of 2017. It still hasn't been signed because, as you refer to, there's a bit of a dispute going on. The current kind of suggestion is that players involved in the 100 will pay back 12.5% of their county salary from their county team to the club, because they're going to be missing the county's games to represent a completely different team, a franchise team,
yes,
a city based team.
The 100 is a whole, not just a new tournament, but it is a new set of teams as well.
Exactly. So there's going to be London franchises, two of them, which are going to include Surrey, Middlesex, and Kent, and possibly Essex as well. So, yeah, it's going to be not the counties representing. So, not totally unreasonably, there's a suggestion that they'll have to remunerate the counties with some of their salary, but I do think that 12.5%, an eighth of your salary, I don't know, county cricketers don't earn a fortune, and it's possible as well, so there's going to be, it's all quite complex, but there are going to be five salary bands for the 100, the lowest of which is just $25,000. So, you know, without getting too kind of into the technicalities and the numbers, it's feasible that you're not actually earning much by playing in the 100.
No, which you're only making an extra $5,000 a year.
Exactly, which, remember, is something giving the counties a huge financial boon to the tune of £1.2 million, because that's what the ECB had to pay them to essentially get them on side to do it. And the players are going to be saying, hang on, I'm playing in this tournament that's making a lot of people very rich, and I'm making, as you say, $5,000 or $10,000 out of it. It doesn't seem fair. Well, meanwhile, foreign players might be coming in, big overseas stars, making hundreds of thousands. It doesn't seem quite right. So they're trying to get that down only to 10 or 11%, but they're fighting tooth and nail for what they think they're worth. And rightly so, in Daryl Mitchell, the chairman of the PCA, they've got someone who is extremely shrewd at all this, and he's just been voted in for another term, I think, as chairman of that. So for good reason.
Yes, another example, and we've seen it in football, of how important it is that your union is strong and well-run. Guy Watts, Posh Sports reporter, thank you very much for giving us the lowdown on all the latest cricket.
This is Love Sport.
Glory, Tottenham Hotspur, they were singing last night, and rightly so. They are finally into their new stadium, some 680-odd days after leaving it for their temporary home at Wembley, and they just about got the win. From a football perspective, by the way, forget the stadium, Tottenham desperately needed that win. You know, they hadn't won in five in the league. They'd thrown away a third place that looked completely sewn up. They looked like they were never, ever going to give up third place. And all of a sudden, they were dragged back into that battle for Champions League football. But they got the victory. Two second-half goals from Heung-Min Son. And as well, oh my goodness, I've forgotten who scored the second goal. Who scored the second goal, guy? Oh, it was Christian Eriksen, wasn't it? After Harry Kane was robbed of a penalty. You see that? He was sort of hacked down. He's lying on his back with his arms in the air. And Eriksen puts it away. And I'm pretty sure that Kane still wanted the penalty, even though Eriksen scored the goal in front of that south stand. Let's have a listen to what Mauricio Pochettino had to say after the game.
It was very emotional from the beginning, before I started the game. I think this type of moment always you are going to keep in your mind, in your memories, in your heart. And I think it's one of the best moment in my life.
That was Mauricio Pochettino, of course, the Tottenham manager, speaking after Spurs' 2-0 win over Crystal Palace at their brand spanking new stadium last night. There was an opening ceremony, just a minor one, to be fair. I thought they might, you know, have a two-hour ceremony or something, try and get fans in early, but they didn't. There were two dress rehearsal games in advance, and, you know, the under-18s and then the legends as well. Shout out to Mickey Hazard, by the way. Poor guy, massive friend of the station. Ruptured his Achilles playing in the legends games. He's the first major injury at the new Tottenham Stadium, which I'm sure is not a title he would have wanted, but get well soon, Mickey. I'm sure we'll be speaking to you soon. But Tottenham got the win, which they did desperately need. Pochettino talked about the fact that they need to be brave. That was a brave game last night for them, because obviously a massive crowd in, such an emotional time for the team to go out and get the victory. All right, it was scrappy at times, but they did what they needed to do and they did it relatively well. They're back in the hunt for Champions League football next year, which will delight my next guest. Dan Tracy of the eSpurs podcast was at the game. Dan, was it everything you had hoped it might be?
Yes, it was, and more, to be honest.
What was the atmosphere like walking in? Were you blown away by it? Had you been to the test events and stuff?
No, I've got a season ticket, but I sort of held myself back purposely for sort of the main event, as it were. But absolutely breathtaking. I mean, I was at the very top of the north stand, so that's the right-hand side of the TV as you watch it. But, I mean, on the third row from the back, and I can see everything. Like, the sight lines are incredible, and the atmosphere was just, you know, you can't even really compare it. Millions of miles away from Wembley, that's for sure.
So if you're in the north stand, you say, so that's opposite the white wall, as they call it. Now, I've been to the Westfalenstadion at Dortmund, and the best place to see the yellow wall is from the other side of the stadium. So it sounds like you had the best view of it.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't really the sort of the banner element, you know, like Dortmund has the sort of the flags and whatnot. So that will come in time, but certainly the noise is there. So it bodes well for future weeks and months ahead.
How important now is it for Tottenham to build on this over the summer? Because, you know, this squad is starting to look not weary, but a little bit like it's got holes in it. How much work do they need to do over the summer?
Not a great deal, but I think additions will certainly be welcomed because, like you just referenced, I think we've almost had the same sort of 18 to 20 players over like 3 years or so. You know, the nucleus of the squad is almost sort of running on empty. So you think just a couple of additions to sort of freshen things up, and you know, you can't just sort of rely on the same players all the time. I think you need to sort of evolve, and I think all teams need to do that. So I think certainly after not spending money this season, we've almost sort of got away with it. We will do if we get in the top four, but if we do get into the top four, we have to use that as a launch pad to sort of then kick on and keep getting into that bracket next time around.
The people talk a lot about fullbacks, like that's a problem for Tottenham. Kieran Trippier's form seemed to have completely deserted him, for example. Is that maybe the first port of call if you do dip into the transfer market, right back?
Perhaps. I mean, we seem to be well stocked at right back. We've got Aurier, Kyle Walker-Peters as well. Whether they're sort of all at the level we need to be is arguable. But I think, you know, if we are going to get a right back, one or two of them are going to have to go out because otherwise we'll have far too many to choose from. I don't think it's really the first five we need to fight. I think perhaps centre midfield. I know sort of Sissoko has become a cult hero all of a sudden, but I don't really sort of think he's quite at that sort of level where you need to really be winning titles. So I think an extra sort of body in there, especially after losing Dembele in January as well. So, you know, I think there's certainly areas that will be identified to be purchased. I think, yeah, sort of centre midfield right back and maybe another forward option when you consider the likes of Llorente is sort of, you know, losing the battle in father time, and Janssen's never really done anything at Tottenham. So I think another sort of body in that sort of attacking third would be useful also.
The real problem is that Son Heung-min's just too good, because he was Harry Kane's backup, and then you realise that actually, well, we just have to play him every week because he's so good. He needs to be slightly less good, and then you can play him as a backup, because I don't know how you're going to find that. I remember links with Jared Bowen, the whole City striker, but I just wonder whether signing a decent goal scorer from the Championship is the type of player that Tottenham need up front.
Yeah, you're probably right, to be honest. And I don't think, you know, we can really be looking, no disrespect to players of that sort of ilk, but I don't really think, again, it's the kind of player that we need to kick on and make us better. You know, that is young and potential, but you still got to then get the minutes to make yourself earn that potential, haven't you? You know, otherwise you'll just be languishing on the bench and never playing. So there is that danger. And I think perhaps with some, there is a sort of benefit that he's our backup striker, but because he's so versatile, it's not a case of he doesn't play and then Kane's injured and he gets thrown into the limelight and he's rusty, because he's also playing out wide and he's always, you know, he's always sort of match ready, so you can sort of slot him into that centre role as we saw a couple of months back. So, you know, it's probably not our main priority, but you also be nice to have another option, because I think sometimes you need that sort of not just a light for light striker, you need someone you can hold the ball up, be a bit more of a physical presence. And I know Llorente offers that to a certain degree, but I still think you could upgrade that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could be an upgrade on Fernando Llorente, to be honest.
just
finally, Dan, I want to put something to you. What would you rather, Tottenham finish fourth and Arsenal finish third, or Tottenham finish fifth and Arsenal finish sixth? So you've got a choice between Champions League football and finishing behind Arsenal, or no Champions League football, but you still finish ahead of Arsenal.
Oh, Champions League in fourth, because fifth and sixth are the same prize, isn't it? You know, if we both miss out, you know, no one really wins. So I'll take being behind Arsenal if it means you get a top four finish.
Good. That's the sensible option, Dan. There's plenty of Spurs fans who just rather beat Arsenal every week, but that's brilliant. Thanks so much for joining us, Dan. I'm glad you managed to come down after what must have been an electric night. That's Dan Tracy of the eSpurs podcast, who was at that amazing stadium last night to see Spurs make history. Well, sort of history. Everything's history, isn't it? But they did get a win after a nervy first 45 minutes. And that, remember, is going to be one of the challenges for Spurs. I was listening to Franny Benali earlier this week, and he was one of the guys who went from the Dell to St Mary's at Southampton. And he said that at the beginning, every game felt like an away game because you weren't used to the surroundings. And much as you had the noise, you just didn't really have the familiarity with the stadium. So that's going to be absolutely crucial to Tottenham. And they can't afford to have any bedding in time because they've got four home games for the rest of the season. Now, West Ham, Man City, Chelsea and Cardiff. Now, two of those you might think are gimmies. Two of them are most definitely not. And they've got to face Man City and Chelsea in the space of 4 days. So that will probably make or break their season, you would think. 24th of April, 28th of April, Man City visit, then Chelsea visit. Remember also they've got the small matter of a Champions League quarter-final against Manchester City. I don't know whether that will distract them. I don't know whether it'll tire them. The problem is they're a small squad. So if they do start picking up injuries, they need to make sure that they can overcome them in a short space of time. Looking at the race for the top four, now Spurs, of course, back up to third. Arsenal still have a game in hand on them. 63 points, plays 64 there. Chelsea level on points with Arsenal and Manchester United two back. You have to feel like now United are in a spot of bother because I'm not saying the wheels have come off and Wolves are an excellent side and they've undone plenty of others. But you do wonder whether he can pick his squad back up again. The advantage he has is really they only play City of the other top six sides in their run-in. Everything else, Huddersfield at home, Brighton at home, West Ham at home, Everton at home and Bournemouth away. Those home games play massively into their hands, I think, because at Old Trafford, United just are a different prospect. It's what happens when you've got a slightly brittle squad. All right, they've produced the results away from home, but when you've got those scars left by Jose Mourinho, it does affect them. Now, speaking of scars, this Chelsea squad might come out of this season with a few, given the treatment they've had from the manager, from the fans, but he did give them what they wanted last night. Loftus-Cheek started, Callum Hudson-Odoi started, Olivier Giroud started, and they all impressed manager Maurizio Sarri.
Callum improved a lot in the last period. For the first time in the season, Loftus is without the problem with his back. So we were lucky. Giroud is in a very good moment.
That was Maurizio Sarri talking about the men he finally gave a start to. Callum Hudson-Odoi, of course, had his first Premier League start last night. Phil Foden, by the way, also started his first Premier League game. But a little bit of maybe a watershed moment, that, for English football. Certainly two of the brightest sparks around playing Premier League games from the start. Chelsea were fluent last night, which there was even some one-touch football going on. I don't know if you noticed that. I haven't seen that for Chelsea for a long time. It's not what Maurizio Sarri wants them to do necessarily. I thought, much as Hudson-Odoi played well, much as Loftus-Cheek played all right, you know who I thought the biggest difference was last night? N'Golo Kante. He was legitimately a real bright light in midfield. I think he picks when to get forward better and better every week. I know it's not his natural game. I know it's what he won those PFA Player of the Year awards doing. But he does have great energy. And, you know, you look at him using that energy horizontally. Why not use it vertically on the pitch? Why not turn yourself into a player who can break into the box? I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility he can turn into that player. And every now and again, you see bursts of it. I think you saw it last night. His speed of pass, his accuracy of pass, his selection of pass. You combine that with the energetic and hard-working nature. We haven't seen a proper box-to-box midfielder in the Premier League in a long time. That's partly because of teams not playing 4-4-2 anymore. But I wonder if N'Golo Kante might just be turning into exactly that.
This is Love Sport.
I wonder if Lee Bowyer might get a little distracted. Reason being, look, he's been fabulous since he took over at Charlton in March last year. And he still hasn't got a contract for next season, which will be a worry for Charlton fans at the moment because the QPR job has come up. And high up the list of people who might be interested is Lee Bowyer. We understand QPR are intrigued by the prospect of appointing him, and you can understand why, because look at what he's done so far this season. Charlton are a shoo-in to get into League One playoffs. I think they might fall at that final hurdle, but he's done very well to get them up into a very solid fifth position. They play good football as well. They work on a tight budget. And I don't see why QPR wouldn't be interested. But Charlton are still in control of this if they do it the right way. My worry is they're very much at risk of mucking things up after a season of very much managing and dealing with different difficult circumstances. The Addicts are very impressively basically, you know, into the playoffs. They've got a buffer, I think, of 15 points. They've developed some great young players. They've got the fans believing in the team, and they've staved off the constant protests and the problems that the ownership of Roland de Châtelet has sort of brought with it. It would have been easy, I think, for them to have crumbled, for the dressing room to go to pieces and get distracted by what was going on and by the fact that you might not have a job next year, the club might change hands, and then who knows what's going to happen. When that starts to take hold, what most players, and let's not blame them for it, what responsible players will do is start looking around. And they'll say to the agent, look, mate, I don't know exactly what the situation is here. Can you see what else is out there? And when you're thinking about leaving, your brain isn't completely focused on the job in hand, no matter how strong you are psychologically. So it would have been very easy for Charlton to go to pieces this season, and they haven't. And I think you have to put a lot of that down to leadership, because that is where it all comes from. Lee Bowyer getting up every day in training and hearing the whispers and hearing the worries and saying, look, lads, don't worry. The important thing is we do this, this and this. If we get into the championship, that's going to make such a difference. We are able to. We're good enough. And I think the players genuinely believe in him. I spoke to Darren Prattley on the station recently. You know, a guy who's been around the block. He knows what it's like to be at a club in financial trouble. He was at Bolton, of course. And he said, you know what? I think Lee Bowyer is fitter than all of us. He's 42. And I think he is still very fit. And players, sometimes they look at a manager and go, what do you know? You've not played football in 30 years. You don't know anything. It's not necessarily fair, but I think some players think that way. And Bowyer seems to command the respect of that dressing room, which is very, very important. Now he has to try and continue to command that respect with this cloud of uncertainty floating around him. It would be an absolute disaster for Charlton to lose him, which makes it even more worrying to hear him say, after a contract offer landed in his inbox last night, if I'm honest, I don't really understand it. I think Richard Murray, he's the director, will be in today to go through it. It's a bit different to a normal contract they've ever seen before, so we'll see what happens. I mean, that feels like a cock-up to me, frankly. That is not how you want to be conducting your business, because what you should do is, and I'm assuming this phone call's already taken place, and they've had a conversation and gone, what do you think, Lee? Do you want to stay? He says yes. They talk about numbers, how long, how much, and then a contract gets drafted through, either to his agent or to him or to both. Now, for him to then look at it and go, this isn't like one I've ever seen before, that is very curious, because it's not as though Lee Bowyer is very green. As I say, he's 42. He's played for something like 6 different professional clubs. So, and of course, he already has one managerial contract. So I'd be surprised if it's that different from the one he's already got. It is curious, and I'm intrigued to know how this will play out. If I were QPR, I'd be getting him in a job interview and getting him potentially under contract. If I'm Lee Bowyer, and he said he was flattered by the interest, as he would be, I think it's important to handle this the right way. If he gets offered the QPR job, he cannot go now. He cannot abandon a club on the verge of playoffs. That would be just football suicide. No fan would ever take him seriously ever again. They'd be burning shirts with his name on it and stuff. It would be awful. If he wants to take the QPR job, I don't blame him. It won't be easy, but I can understand the attraction. But he has to stay to the end of the season. He has to say to the players, look, lads, I'm completely committed to you for the rest of this year. This is what we've all been working towards. I've got this new job. And they would all understand, I think, when he says you'd all do the same thing. So, Lee, if you're listening, and I know you're a big fan, just of the station and of me, frankly, who's not. If you're listening, do the right thing, do it the right way, and do it soon.
This is Love Sport.
Yeah, a special moment for Harry Winks last night, coming off the bench to make his 100th appearance for Tottenham. And he, I think, maybe embodies what Tottenham feel like they're all about now, which is bringing through local guys. You know, he's a Hemel Hampstead lad. He's Tottenham through and through. He's a Tottenham fan. Went to his first Spurs game when he was 6 years old. And he is one of those people who they will always sing the name. He's one of our own, they'll always sing. He's a classy player. And I think that is partly what Pochettino and Tottenham want to build. You know, someone asked me if Mauricio Pochettino was going to be the next Sir Alex Ferguson. I don't think that's an unfair comparison for anyone, to be perfectly honest, because he wants to be part of a dynasty. That does really get him going. You look at what he was like at Espanyol and how he said he would never take the Barcelona job because he's so fiercely loyal to Espanyol. And I think that says a lot about the type of man that he is and what you might see from him in the next couple of years. But it's absolutely crucial now that the club work the right way with him. They've done one thing that he definitely needed, which is to move to a bigger stadium. Daniel Levy said yesterday, you can't be a big club in a 36,000-seater stadium. And he's absolutely right. In modern football, look at the great cathedrals of football around Europe that the big teams play in. The Allianz Arena, the Bernabeu, the Camp Nou, the Wanda Metropolitano. These are all stadia of massive clubs. Really big clubs. Tottenham and White Hart Lane were punching way above their weight. And now they're in a stadium that befits the sort of status that they want to command in European football. But what have they not got? And that's a squad to match a club in the top echelon of European football. Daniel Levy, understandably, has held off spending on players big because they've got a lot of loans to pay for this £1 billion stadium. They've just posted, by the way, world record profits. I think £113 million. But there's a lot of loan repayments to go with the stadium now. That is how football clubs work. They always speculate to accumulate with a huge amount of debt. But they haven't signed a player in so long. And Levy needs to stand up now and say, I've delivered this stadium. But the job is only half done. Pochettino has repeatedly talked about how much he needs players to make the squad work. They've got a great first team. They've got a great, great first team. There are problems. I think right-back's a problem. You know, we spoke to someone earlier saying, well, they've got Serge Aurier, they've got Kyle Walker-Peters, they've got Kieran Trippier. I think none of those is a top-class fullback at right-back. Kyle Walker-Peters might be one day, but not at the moment. Hugo Lloris is starting to look like he might be flawed, so then you've got to spend on a goalkeeper. Who backs up Harry Kane all the time? Can't always be Heung-Min Son, he plays a lot anyway. Central midfield is an issue as well. Harry Winks is a decent player. Is he the type of player that they're looking for? I don't know. I think they need to replace Moussa Dembele, personally. I don't think Moussa Sissoko is the long-term option there. So there are still a lot of questions to be asked of Mauricio Pochettino here. And he cannot be let down by Daniel Levy. Because I think if I were Mauricio Pochettino, and an offer came in from Real Madrid, let's say next summer, let's say Zidane walks away again, and Levy has only spent maybe £60 million on players this summer, and Tottenham finish fourth again, then what do you do? Then what does Mauricio Pochettino do? I think he walks away, and I think he has to. And similarly, the last few games of this season, the last six games of this Premier League season, are absolutely crucial. Remember those advertising hoardings that Spurs got warned over as the only place in London to watch Champions League football? Well, it turns out you can still watch Champions League football there, but they were warned about it, and it did smack a little bit of arrogance and an assumption. I talked yesterday about Shahid Khan saying, we got relegated in August, we thought that was impossible. You always have to be realistic in football. You can be ambitious, but you have to understand the risks involved. And at the moment, there is a very real risk that Tottenham will not have Champions League football. You don't want to be playing at Dynamo Tbilisi on a Thursday night in a 62,000-seater, although technically not allowed that for football, a 59,000-seater stadium. It's going to look very silly. It'll become a white elephant. And let's say they don't play in the Champions League. What if that Thursday night thing that we know affects people in the Premier League, and if we've got a top six that's more competitive than ever, what if they miss out on Champions League football again? Then are players still going to start signing for Tottenham? Oh, we've got this great new stadium. Yeah, but you're playing a team I've never heard of from Lithuania in it. What's the point? This is a really crucial moment in Tottenham's history. I love Tottenham as a club. I think they're an interesting club, and I have a lot of good friends who are Tottenham fans. And I want them to succeed at the highest level. But at the moment, I'm worried that if they don't take seriously the risks that they're facing in terms of squad and personnel, then they will not be able to succeed at the highest level. Daniel Levy needs to look at those profits and say, right, we have to reinvest. These loan repayments are what they are. We need to invest in playing staff. Harry Kane can't play 60 games a season for the rest of his life. Dele Alli, the same. Christian Eriksen needs a new contract, or he's going to go to Real Madrid. Tottenham have managed to get this stadium done, eventually. But they weren't realistic about the delays. They drip-fed information to the fans, and now they're not being realistic about their squad unless they prove otherwise over the summer. So this is a very serious message for Tottenham and for Daniel Levy. You didn't believe your stadium was going to be delayed. And it was. You didn't have a good communication with your fans about the stadium. So now you need to be open and honest and say to your manager, we're going to give you a big old war chest this summer. Because otherwise, if Tottenham miss out on Champions League football, the repercussions could be very, very serious.
This is Love Sport.
I'm delighted to say that on the line we have Dave Caldwell, renowned boxing trainer. Remember that BT Sport will broadcast the Ultimate Boxer series on TV and on YouTube starting on the 10th of May from the Indigo at O2. Dave, for those who don't necessarily know Ultimate Boxer, tell us a little bit about the format and why the series is so different from ordinary boxing nights.
Well, it's different because it's basically a knockout tournament. And tournament is the key word, really. You have a quarterfinal, semifinal, and then the final. It leads to, you know, it's exciting night of action, really. Because the fights are only three rounds each, then there's no time to really go in there, figure your opponents out, you know, get behind the jab, just box a little bit. You've got to make sure that you're busy. You've got to make sure that it's the, you know, you're catching the judge's eye. And nine times out of ten, you're always going to see in these fights, you're going to get knockdowns because the two fighters tend to go at it. And they know they've got three rounds, so they put everything into those three rounds.
From a training perspective, I imagine that does make it very different because you can't build a game plan in the same way that you ordinarily would in the build-up to a fight.
Yeah, it is. It's different. It's different because obviously in normal boxing, then you know you've got longer, you've got more rounds to figure your opponents out, and you know you can have quite a few different game plans for a fight. You still have to have a game plan, but you've got to be very careful that you don't let the clock run away and you just, you know, get out hustled by your opponent. You don't have to go to war to win this tournament because what tends to happen is that you forget that if you have a tough fight in the quarterfinals, you've still got a fight, you know, a short duration later in the semi-final. If you have another tough fight in the semi-final, by the time you get to the final, you're absolutely shattered and you've got nothing left. So it takes an element of boxing skill to win the tournament. It's just that the way it works out is you do tend to get a lot of drama, a lot of action in these fights. Because also what you've got is the competitors in Ultimate Boxer, they're not household names yet. They've got nothing to protect. They've got nothing to lose. It's about going out there and making a name. So they will give it everything. They want the crowd to remember because if you go out there and you outbox your way to victory, then really, if the crowd aren't buzzing and if they're not shouting and screaming and excited, then you know it's great you've won it. And yes, you've had the fantastic paycheck at the end, but nobody's really going to remember you and think about you moving forward. However, if you go out there and you're exciting, that can really open doors for you beyond the tournament.
Yeah, I was thinking of, you know, the previous things like Prize Fighter that did, yeah, you know, propel people onto a greater audience. Of this, yeah. So on the 10th of May, we've got a middleweight tournament at the Indigo at the O2. Of those eight pro boxers, we've got the lineup now. Who's sort of caught your eye early on? Who are you really excited about seeing in the ring?
Well, do you know what? I've given up on predicting or having expectations that who's going to win these tournaments because you can't tell because you get these guys that have got experience in boxing 10 rounders. You know, there's a Southern Area champion in there. What I think we've had before in the previous one, there was an English champion or a Celtic champion in there. I can't remember which. You know, guys that are experienced over 10 rounds, but you put them in three rounders and it's completely different. So, you know, you mentioned Prize Fight. I remember prize fight was doing great, and then they started putting bigger names in because everybody wanted to be a part of it. And then when you got the bigger names in with the experience and with the reputations, the fights weren't as good because they were thinking about what's happening. Nobody wants to see that over three rounds. Nobody wants to see that on these tournaments, as I say. So really, I've stopped predicting because I never get them right. Somebody can look great on the first fight in the quarterfinals. They can look great on the second fight in the semifinals. But, you know, they're having three fights in one night, and on the third and final night fight, they might just run out of steam. I will say that on the last one, the minute I saw Shakhan Peters, I knew that he was going to win it. Just with his style and his range, and you know the size of him, he was always going to be hard to beat. You know, and add his boxing ability to that, he was always going to be hard to beat over three rounds. But that's when I tend to make my prediction. Is when I've seen them all fight on that first night, then I'll kind of like think, yeah, he's the man to beat, really.
Right, that'll be the point to text you and find out exactly what your predictions are. They make me do predictions for the football on this show. It's incredibly unfair. It's really hard to do. It makes me look like an idiot, so you're sensible to avoid them. Boxing at the moment, what I like about this format is that it forces people to get in the ring and you get a lot of fights, and I think that's what fans want. Boxing at the moment, it seems, is going through a slightly frustrating period, certainly, you know, in the big money heavyweight division, where you've got a lot of fighters avoiding each other. Are we going to have to learn to be very, very patient to see the fights that we want to see?
The thing is, you're talking about frustration, yes, but it is mainly in the heavyweight division. If you look at the other divisions, all the big fights are happening. You know, you're getting some great fights put together. Let's talk about the heavyweight division. Yeah, you've got AJ, you've got Fury, and you've got Deontay Wilder. Those three fighters are at the absolute pinnacle. They're the three best fighters, in that division, and we want to see them fight each other. But there's a lot of politics, you know, different TV networks and things like that that are getting in the way. The people around them getting in the way. I generally believe that each fighter wants to fight each other. You know, that they've got no fear of each other. That's why they're at the top. You know, people saying, "Oh, he's scared." Neither fighter's scared of each other, but it's the teams around them that are wanting to, you know, maximize their earning potential. And you have to understand from each fan's point of view, they want the best deal that they can get. But you've also got to marry that up with the fact that if you're used to only getting a small amount, then what would still be a massive amount. You've got to look at it and think, well, I wouldn't get that if I don't take this fight, and I believe that I'm going to beat this man, then let's take the fight. But, they're holding out for, you know, even more obscene amounts. And it's frustrating. It's frustrating as a fan because we want to see them all fight. And you know what? We could see multiple fights between them. And that's the problem I do believe that, you know, you've got fights there that you could see rematches, you could see rubber matches in there, you could see three fights between them, and that keeps them going for a couple of years. But the way that it's going, we're going to be lucky to see one. But if one fight gets made between them, then the other man, the odd man out, is going to want to get involved, and so you will see him. I think just that first fight's got to happen, and then it'll kickstart the whole triangle.
Well, people keep saying to me we had to wait a long time for Ali Frazier, and that worked out all right. So I'm hoping that is how it goes. Just finally, Dave, I want to ask you, because it's coming up, Ankh Crawley getting in the ring with Vasily Lomachenko. Now, even the casuals seem to enjoy watching Vasily Lomachenko box. Yeah. That wasn't always the case for the smaller guys. I mean, this is obviously a big day for Ankh Crawley in the Sun. Has he got any chance of troubling a man who might be the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world?
Do you know what? It's a massive, massive ask, and it's a task that I'm very familiar with because I had Tony Bellew himself going against a very, very similar fight, a stable mate of Lomachenko in Usyk, and where the whole world say you have got absolute zero chance. It's just you, your fighter, and your camp that believe that you've got an opportunity, you've got a chance, you can find a weakness, and you have to have that belief, and you do believe. Otherwise, you know, you don't take the fight. He's got a massive opportunity because it's the same sort of position where nobody believes in you. You don't have the pressure on you. You can go in there and you can just give of your best. As long as you go in there and you give of your best, then, you know, anything in boxing can happen. Any fighter can beat anybody. Buster Douglas beat Tyson. Nobody expected it. You know, you look at what Fury did with Klitschko. Nobody expected it. So, you know, there are big shocks that happen in boxing. It's just a very, very tough task. And looking at them both on the careers that I've had, the stage that Ant's at the moment, you know, the ability that Lomachenko's got, you know, you look at it and you think, wow, that's just such a tough, tough task.
But credit to him for taking it.
Of course. And, you know, the thing is, I've seen people on social media slagging him off for taking the fight. I don't get this. You know, in this day and age, people look at it and if you don't take a fight, you're seen as a bottle job. If you do take a fight, you cash your name, you're being crazy, you shouldn't be going anywhere.
You can't win. No, you can't. That's Twitter for you, Dave. I could talk about this all day, but we've got to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. That's Ultimate Boxer Ambassador and renowned trainer, Dave Caldwell. Remember that BT Sport will be broadcasting the Ultimate Boxer Series live on TV and YouTube starting on Friday the 10th of May from the Indigo at the O2 Arena.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.